Today is Monday, January 23rd. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Good evening. It's 5:04 p.m., and welcome to our second special episode covering the 2012 UBC Alma Mater Society elections. Today, News 101 is hosting a debate with the candidates for Vice President Academic and University Affairs, as well as the candidate for the Vice President External. Stay tuned to hear their opinions on issues that matter most to our listeners here at UBC. All of this plus your weekday weather forecast, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now, we begin today with our interview with the candidate for VP External, Kyle Warwick.
You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm sitting here with the VP External candidate in the AMS elections of 2012. This is Kyle Warwick. Welcome to News 101.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Kyle, tell us about your campaign platform.
Sure. Well, I've got a number of sort of key points, but mostly they fall under two general headings. The first of those is transit and improvements there, because that's an issue that affects every student, whether or not they pay attention to the AMS. So within the heading of transit, I've got two main priorities. First of all, the UPass program is coming up for renewal and for renegotiation this year, so that's going to be a responsibility of the next VP External to make sure that we continue to have a good rate on the UPass. Now, TransLink has said that they want to increase the cost of the UPass, and we need to be very firm in saying to them, without service increases, continually increasing the cost of the UPass is not an acceptable outcome. Secondly, we need to really push to clear up the Broadway corridor, because right now, that corridor is grossly underserved, and we can't solve that problem by adding more buses. It's already at a saturation point during the peak hours, and studies have shown that adding more B-lines will not alleviate the congestion. So what we need to push is for the UBC Rapid Transit line. Now, that's a really beneficial line, first of all, for students, because it will reduce our commute times to campus, but it's also something that can gain a lot of support, and has already been gaining support throughout the region, because it helps businesses, which helps us economically, and it helps commuters throughout that corridor. Broadway is a busier corridor right now than Cambie was before it got the Canada line. So it's a regional priority, not just a priority for UBC students. So those are my two main priorities on transit, and I'm happy to elaborate more on them, and you can read a bit more also at votewarwick.ca. And my other main area that I think is of broad interest for students is in terms of student financial aid and specifically student loan reform. We see a lot of problems with the student loan system in BC. First of all, one of the strange things about our system is we have something called a six-month grace period where you don't have to pay back your loans. But during that period, interest is still accumulating on your loans, so it's not really a grace period. It's really a misnomer. And that's something that is not the case in a lot of other jurisdictions, and it's a very unreasonable and confusing thing, and it's not a huge cost to the province to address that and to make the grace period an interest-free true grace period. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly specifically at UBC, is that the student loan program allocates just over $500 per month at maximum for housing allowance. And that's just not adequate to live at UBC. We see the apartments, even off campus in a basement, you very well may be paying more than $500, and certainly if you're living on the residence, you're going to be paying, you know, upwards of $800 to live at Marine Drive, and similarly, slightly less if you're living in certain other residences. But Gage, Marine Drive, Fairview, you're paying vastly more than $500. And UBC Board of Governors has said they'd like to work with us to harmonize our lobbying on that. So I think that's a really pragmatic thing that we can really get done, and I think it's going to benefit a lot of students who have the high cost of living out here at UBC.
Great. Thanks, Kyle. So one of the first questions to start off is, obviously one of the key roles of your position will be to lobby for financial aid reform on behalf of the student body. So why do you think previous attempts at provincial lobbying have not succeeded in ways that students can understand and appreciate? Is it a question of not being able to cooperate and communicate well with different groups in the society?
I think there's a couple of key points. One of the keys, I think, is that in recent years, the AMS has been focusing very, very heavily on federal lobbying. And federal lobbying certainly has its place, because it's where, for instance, funding for Aboriginal students, for graduate student research, and for international students, and for their work credentials, those kind of decisions are made at the federal level. However, education is most directly a provincial responsibility, and in recent years, I think we haven't quite invested enough effort in that. Fortunately, this year we've started to see that turn around, and I think the current president and VP External have done a great job starting up the Where's the Funding campaign, which is going to be hitting campus during February, and that's going to be a really high visibility campaign that I think a lot of students are going to see very clearly. And that's a campaign, it's very exciting, we're working with all of the other major student societies at SFU, UNBC, UVic, University of Fraser Valley, Capilano, and numerous other ones. And so that's a really exciting initiative, and I think that's where we're going to start to see some more value. But I think if we get too distracted on federal issues, which are important, you know, there's only so much time in the day and there's only so much resources that we have, so we have to allocate them in the most effective way we can. And, you know, I think in recent years our priorities haven't been quite right about that. And I think that's something that's starting to get addressed, and I'm going to continue to move that focus more and more towards the provincial side and towards the TransLink side, because I think that's where there's the most direct impact on students.
Right. So you obviously also be involved with ensuring reasonable tuition rates, right? So how does your position respond to students who are really concerned about the ever-rising costs of tuition and also ever-rising costs of housing?
Well, I think that's a really good point to link tuition to the other determinants of the cost of education. Because tuition itself is actually a pretty small portion of the overall cost of living in Vancouver. And now, the position I have is basically in agreement with the AMS policy that currently exists, which says, first of all, our main priority is that inflation never is, that tuition never rises faster than the rate of inflation. In other words, in real terms, we don't have tuition increases. Secondly, I think we need to look at the situation with international students in that they face huge, vastly higher tuition, and they face a lot of more uncertainty in their tuition as well, in that in recent years it's gone up by unpredictable amounts, and domestic has consistently gone up by about the same amount. So that's one concern. But, you know, I think it's important that we sort of prioritize things where we actually can make changes. And we see right now that UBC is not budging on tuition, but they're very willing to start to work on areas such as student loan reform. And they're very willing to start working on having that student financial aid cover the actual cost of housing. They've said that's something that they want to work on. And that's something that, frankly, has at least as much of an impact as tuition and is much more achievable. So for that reason, that's where I'm focusing my energy. I think tuition reform is a very important thing. And certainly, if we can lower tuition and still maintain a good quality of education, that's important. But in the immediate term, we have to prioritize, and I'm going to prioritize on things that are not just good sounding or politically easy, but are actually achievable.
Great. Getting back to TransLink, as you said, one of your future goals as VP External will be to improve transit and to introduce the rapid transit system to the UBC campus, which most people know is arguably the largest transit demographic on the Lower Mainland. So tell us how you intend to make sure the students' voice is represented within TransLink's own priorities, especially given that they're pushing for the Surrey transit system.
Well, there's a couple of really key points here. First of all, there's been a bit of development on the priorities that Surrey has and in terms of where they fit into the region as a whole. So first of all, Surrey's new priority currently is that they don't want rapid rail now. What they want is light rail distributed in several different areas. And the reason is that Surrey's population is quite large, but it's not concentrated on one specific corridor in the way ours is. So that's a slightly different priority. So our priorities are not at all at odds with Surrey. In fact, I think they're very much complementary. And in fact, due in large part to a previous AMS campaign, we saw a really exciting change in the regional growth strategy, which is that Metro Vancouver's position now is that Surrey and our line are of equal priority, and originally it was that Surrey had a higher priority than us.
Yep.
And thanks to the advocacy that happened about 2 years ago, we are now at an equal standing. So that's a positive thing just to start with. And in terms of pushing things further, there's a number of key things to do. One of them is to really leverage the fact that a provincial election is coming up in just over a year, and that means that the province is going to be thinking politically, and they're going to be very receptive to, you know, a voter base of approximately 47,000 people. And you got to remember that the premier's riding is including UBC, so that's really important. So we should definitely leverage that. Another thing that we need to do is have well-researched policy. Right now we have a policy saying that we want the line, and it has a lot of empirical backing, but there's a lot more research that we can do to fully flesh out the details there. And I've got a lot of experience in writing detailed policy with my previous experience at the AMS, and I think that that's something that I can really contribute. And I guess lastly, in terms of sort of mobilizing average students, I think this is an issue that really is great for that, because, you know, the AMS has tried to do a lot of things to engage students, and sometimes it hasn't quite worked. Sometimes, you know, it's a bit hard to explain to students, you know, there's something called Electoral Area A, you should really vote. But transit, that's something everyone gets. Everyone pays for a U-Pass, and everyone understands how they can benefit from that. So I think mobilizing students on a campaign there is something that's very achievable and will really help to leverage, to increase our leverage with the government.
Yeah, speaking of the U-Pass, obviously your position will be responsible for making sure that it's affordable, but in what areas do you think the program as a whole suffers?
Well, on the whole, I think that it's a fantastic program, absolutely. I think it is somewhat inconvenient, the fact that, you know, these current measures that are intended to prevent fraud, you know, there are some inconveniences such as going to the bookstore every month. And that's especially inconvenient, for instance, for co-op students who might not ordinarily be on campus. But I think that those inconveniences are a lot less important than the question of what is the cost and how does that compare to the service level. So I'm not terribly worried about those, because they're going to be alleviated in any case because of the fact that the new Compass system is coming out. And that's an electronic fare card that TransLink is going to introduce. And the U-Pass is going to be integrated into that system. So my main priority is less to do with these administrative wrinkles and more to do with ensuring that the cost of the U-Pass does not go up unreasonably unless we see tangible improvements in service.
Great. So that's fantastic, Kyle. Would you like to tell our listeners where they can vote for you and till when?
Oh, absolutely, yes. So voting's open right now, and it runs until 5 o'clock on January 27th. So it's running for the remainder of this week. You vote at www.ams.ubc.ca/elections. There's a big button on it that says vote. And in order to vote, you're going to need a username and password that UBC is going to have emailed to you. It'll go to whatever email you have registered on the SSC, and it'll be a series of random letters and numbers. So then you put that in, and then you're able to vote. I just voted, and it takes not even 2 minutes. So I really hope you'll do that, and I really hope you'll vote yes for Kyle Warwick.
Great. Thank you. That was Kyle Warwick, a candidate for VP External in the 2012 AMS elections.
And thanks very much to CJ for that interview with Kyle Warwick, the candidate for VP External for the AMS. We're going to take a quick break right now, but stay tuned with us for the weather and more exciting AMS coverage coming right up. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Février 2012, c'est le 10e marathon des sans-abri, une diffusion radiophonique pan-canadienne de 14h sur les enjeux du logement et de l'itinérance. Un toit, c'est un droit.
Pour se sortir de la rue, d'avoir son logement, d'avoir une qualité de vie, d'avoir un téléphone, quelque chose de même. Je m'excuse, je t'enragis aux autres à travers le Canada. tu sais, des personnes itinérantes, là, c'est des humains pareils comme vous autres. Pensez-y donc une minute, parce que ça pourrait vous arriver une journée. Je m'excuse, là, je t'arrête.
Le marathon sera diffusé par plusieurs stations de radio communautaires à travers le Québec et le Canada. Syntonisez CKUT 90.3 FM de 17h jusqu'à 7h du matin dans la nuit du 22 au 23 février 2012. Pour plus d'informations ou pour participer, contactez marathon à ckut.ca ou appelez au 514-448-4041, poste 6788.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and we're going to go to our intrepid weatherman, Phil, right now for our weather weekday weather update.
All right. Thank you, Claire. And good evening, listeners. Looking on the global forecast system model yesterday, we're in for a week of typical Vancouver weather. Rain, rain, and more rain. Currently, a low-pressure trough is coming in to replace the high-pressure ridge from the weekend, bringing us vertical motion and instability, often associated with dynamic weather. For the next few days, we're expecting at least 10 millimeters of accumulated precipitation each, so don't forget to pick up your umbrella as you head out each morning. Now, here's your 7-day long-term weather forecast for UBC. Tuesday, lots of rain, possibly up to 25 millimeters accumulated over 24 hours. High of 9, low of 5. Wednesday, rain. Up to 10 millimeters of accumulated precipitation. High of 9, low of 6. Thursday, cloudy. High of 7, low of 4. Friday, a peak of sunshine. High of plus 5, low of minus 1. Saturday, cloudy with showers. High of plus 6, low of minus 1. Sunday, rain. High of 7, low of 1. So that's your weather forecast for UBC this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 7 degrees here on campus. I'm with Martin, Claire, and CJ in the sub. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Great. Thanks as always, Phil, for your weather report. Even though it looks a bit gloomy, it's good to know what we're in for. And so now, for those of you who maybe aren't as engaged with our AMS elections, but are more interested in the events still going on campus, we have an event from Stand UBC, an AMS club on campus that advocates to end genocide and other crimes against humanity, specifically in Darfur and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And they do have a very interesting panel discussion coming up tomorrow night. That's Tuesday, January 24th at 5:30 p.m. They're going to be having a panel discussion on trade versus aid in southern Sudan. And this panel discussion will be featuring a representative from an NGO, a South Sudanese student, a UBC professor of political science, and an MP from the Vancouver region. So once again, that's a Stand UBC panel discussion tomorrow night at 5:30 in the Dodson Room in the Irving K. Barber Learning Center. So if you are able to make that, it should be an interesting debate. So now we're going to go to a piece that our reporter Martin Lemon put together for us. Once again, you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
As you know, your ex-wife gave an interview to ABC News and another interview with the Washington Post, and this story has now gone viral on the internet. In it, she says that you came to her in 1999, at a time when you were having an affair. She says you asked her, sir, to enter into an open marriage. Would you like to take some time to respond to that?
No, but I will.
And with those wild allegations, the GOP primary race has been thrown wide open, at least temporarily. This time last week, only a financial masochist would have bet against Mitt Romney. But Mitt's had a tough week. His Iowa caucus victory was stripped away and handed to Rick Santorum, a state it now seems Mitt lost by a mere 34 votes. Then things went from bad to worse for Mitt.
Back in 1967, your father set what was then a groundbreaking standard in American politics. He released his tax returns. He released them for not 1 year, but for 12 years. When you release yours, will you follow your father's example?
Maybe. I don't know how many years I'll release. I'll take a look at what what our documents are.
Republicans wanted to see his tax returns, and Romney's hesitation not only cost him dearly, but was taken advantage of swiftly by his opponents.
If there's anything in there that is going to help us lose the election, we should know it before the nomination. And if there's nothing in there, why not release it? I mean, it's a very simple model. But as he's got to decide, it's his decision, and everybody's got to run their own campaign based on what they think is the reasonable risk. I released mine this evening. We also released the little small charitable foundation we have so people can see what we do and how we did it and what our values are.
Despite Romney trying desperately to cling to his front-runner status, it's been wrestled away from him by Newt Gingrich, who swept South Carolina, taking all 23 delegates with him. But of course, none of this would be possible without one man's endorsement.
In the eyes of a ranger, the unsuspecting stranger had better know the truth of wrong from right. Cause the eyes of the ranger are...
That's right, folks. Chuck Norris came out this week and publicly endorsed Newt Gingrich for president, probably single-handedly swinging all this momentum in Newt's favor, because we all know the deep and sincere respect the Walker Texas Ranger commands in American politics. Yes, fortune truly smiled on Newt this week. First Chuck Norris, then the open marriage allegations. Only in American politics could a petty personal matter that happened nearly 15 years ago be taken seriously. Newt Gingrich cheated on his wife in the late 90s, at a time when he was leading the crusade to have President Clinton impeached for the very same sin.
Isn't that hypocrisy?
No. Look, obviously it's complex, and obviously I wasn't doing things to be proud of. On the other hand, what I said very clearly, and I knew this in part having gone through a divorce. I'd been in depositions. I'd been in situations where you had to swear to tell the truth. I understood that in a federal court, in a case, in front of a federal judge, to commit a felony, which is what he did, perjury was a felony. And the question I raised was very simple. Should a president of the United States be above the law?
And like the Clinton affair, this public intrusion into his personal life has been unreasonably beneficial for Newt. He's handled the allegations well, and his support has skyrocketed because of it.
To take an ex-wife and make it 2 days before the primary a significant question in a presidential campaign is as close to despicable as anything I can imagine.
I must admit that watching Newt Gingrich tear into CNN's John King was about as much fun as shooting rats at the dump.
John, it was repeated by your network. You chose to start the debate with it. Don't try to blame somebody else. You and your staff chose to start this debate with it. Now, let me be quite clear. The story is false.
Newt Gingrich stormed into the South Carolina debate like a ravenous pit bull, which is sort of shocking considering he had almost no leverage coming into South Carolina. I know he absolutely baffled Rick Santorum when he called for the former senator from Pennsylvania to bow out of the race, accusing him of splitting the vote.
For him to suggest that that someone who was tied for first and eventually won the Iowa caucuses had finished with twice as many votes as he did and finished ahead of him in New Hampshire in spite of the fact that he spent an enormous amount more money in both those places, plus had the most important endorsement in the state, the Manchester Union Leader, and I was 10 points behind him a week before the election and then finished ahead of him. So I was 2-0 coming into South Carolina, and I should get out of the race. These are not cogent thoughts. I mean, and let's just be honest. I mean,
one thing can be said for Newt Gingrich. He does, at the very least, have some thoughts. Some are dubious, others outright dangerous. But Republicans don't really seem to mind that much.
Andrew Jackson had a pretty clear-cut idea about America's enemies. Kill them. Congressman Paul, 30 seconds, please. 30 seconds to respond, since you were mentioned.
My point is if another country does to us what we do others, we're not going to like it very much. So I would say that maybe we ought to consider a golden rule in foreign policy. Don't do to other nations what we don't want to have them do to us. So we endlessly bomb these countries, and then we wonder wonder why they get upset with us, and yet it continues on and on. I mean, this idea that we can't debate foreign policy, then all we have to do is start another war. I mean, it's warmongering. They're building up for another war against Iran, and people can't wait to get in another war. This country doesn't need another war.
It's on to Florida now, where 50 delegates are at stake. Florida presents the first opportunity for the candidates to play the big stage. It's widely believed that a candidate cannot be successful in the Sunshine State without spending boatloads in advertising, which might be bad news for the new frontrunner. Despite his recent success, Newt Gingrich is relatively poor in the world of big-time politics in the states. According to the New York Times, Gingrich has just over $300,000 in his campaign reserve, a pittance compared to Romney's $14.5 million, even Ron Paul's $3.5 million. Whoever ends up with a GOP nomination, money will play a significant role. It's a long, treacherous, and ridiculously expensive road to the convention in August. Although Mitt Romney has a small treasury at his disposal, big money changes directions quickly, and usually follows trends. Trendy. It seems an apt word to describe what's happening south of the border. The candidates' politics seem to take a back seat to their image, however fleeting that image might be.
And thanks to Martin Lemlin, as always, for that entertaining and informative piece of news from our southern neighbors. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Pick up your winter issue of Discorder, as the Jan-Sember issue is packed with goodies that will warm even the coldest of cockles. Take a dip with Dixie's Death Pool, a spacey art rock collective, or read up on local outsider pop music makers, World Club. Cozy up on the couch with Filmstripped, featuring a review of Color Me Obsessed, a documentary on The Replacements. And in case you missed the memo, 2012 is almost here. Check out the Discorder album picks of 2011. Don't forget to pick up your special Jan-Sember issue of Discorder.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to our second special edition of interviews with the AMS candidates for the upcoming AMS elections. So I'm joined in studio by Kieran Mahal and Carvin Lee, are two of our candidates for VP Academic. And also there are two other candidates who aren't with us today, Iqbal Qasim and Bahadur Musavi. And also we aren't joined by Party Rock in studio today, but I'm sure we're with him in spirit because it's always a party here in the studio. So first of all, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I guess we'll just start out. If you guys want to introduce yourselves, tell us a bit about yourselves, your platform, why you want to do this. Kieran, we can start with you.
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you guys for letting us come here and talk a little bit about ourselves. So my name is Kieran Mahal, and I'm running for the position of VP Academic and University Affairs. I'm also running in another race in AMS elections for a position as a student senator at large. So I've been involved with student government for the last 2 years. I've been on the SUS executive, first as the director of administration, and now I'm currently the SUS president. I've also worked for the AMS for about 2 years as a student service coordinator, where I've worked at AMS Volunteer Connect, where I coordinate the internship program and also recently founded the externship program. So I've been exposed to the AMS a lot over the last couple of years, and that kind of drew my interest in getting more involved on the student government side for the AMS. So I've been actively involved with council through sitting on a committee, the Student Life Committee, and I also attend council regularly. So I've been exposed to a lot of the different issues that have come up over the last year. So my main platform is centered around three main areas, so the area of academics, university affairs, and the AMS in general. So in the area of academics, I really want to push towards further restructuring of the summer term. That's something that's been worked on by the last two VP academics, and I'd love to kind of finish the work that they've already started. I'd also like to see some more policy introduced surrounding mental health and wellness of students. That's something that's been lacking, and it's evident that mental health is a huge issue at UBC. I'd really like to work on Senate and through the VP Academic Office to bring that forward as something to work on. The other thing is an exam database. So something that UBC is lacking is an open access exam database for all students. So in terms of university affairs, I would like to work on land use and ensuring that we have affordable on-campus housing for students. As well, the issue of governance is coming up to the Board of Governors. And that's something I want to ensure that students as major residents on campus have a say in the new governance structure of UBC. In terms of the AMS, I've worked for the AMS for the last 2 years, so I've got a chance to get to know a lot of the permanent staff and the student staff who work here. And I'd love to see the AMS grow and expand and become stronger with the introduction of a new strategic plan coming up that the last two executive teams have been working on. I'd love to be part of implementing that and ensuring that everyone who's part of the AMS feels like they're a part of this new plan and this new vision for the AMS moving into the new sub and with this new strategic plan. As a president of a constituency, I work with counselors who are very passionate about working on academic issues on the level of their own departments, which is something that the AMS isn't very much involved in. I'd love to see the AMS empower student government on all levels by providing training on advocacy and lobbying to each of these constituencies so that they too can ensure that within their own departments, they're leaders in lobbying for these academic issues. And then in addition to that, I'd love to introduce more mental health policy within the AMS as well, because I think that's something that the AMS has not been focusing on. And as students, we need to look out for each other and ensure that the AMS is the front runner in ensuring that student mental health and wellness is not overlooked. And the last thing I'd like to work on is the services review. So a full external review of the student services that are run by students for students at the AMS, which is where I've worked for the last 2 years. I'd really love to see... I'd really love to be a part of the changes that take place with that and ensuring that we're able to expand our services and ensure that we're providing students with the services they need and giving enough support to our coordinators to ensure they can provide those services. So again, my name is Karen Mahal. I'm running for VP Academic and University Affairs as well as Senate. And you can find out more information about my platform and my experiences on campus on my website, votekaren.com.
Great. Thanks, Karen. And Carmen, on to you.
Yes. Well, thank you indeed for inviting us in. My name is Carvin Lee, and I am running for VP Academic for the AMS elections. I'm an outgoing student leader who is involved with the AUS for 2 years now. And for my 4 years at UBC, I've also been involved with Pride UBC. Right now, I hold the position of political coordinator at Pride UBC and advocacy and wellness coordinator at AUS, the Arts Undergraduate Society. Having those positions, I learned a lot about the social aspects that students want to advocate for. They want a more inclusive, safe environment. And advocacy, I learned a lot about the student desire for curricular change. I had been working with the African Studies Expansion Project. So we hope to expand the minor. I run on the platform of social, academic, and financial effectiveness of our university. So I hope to bring more connections between UBC and AMS in terms of creating a environment that people feel safe, not just physically, but socially also. It's really important that we bring on discussions of systemic discrimination that does exist. Even on the council level, there had been a report about this. And so I really want to bring change, not just on the AMS council political representation level, but also in the whole campus-wide area. For academic, I, like Kieran, really want to continue the work of the past VP academics and expanding the summer term. I feel that the expansion can really help students in all areas of life. That includes social, which means the bringing back of AMS services like SafeWalk, making it more feasible for it to reopen in the summer. And also it gives students who work full-time year-long the option of rearranging their schedule so they can take winter breaks off. Professors can do their field studies easier. And generally, I know a lot of people work 9 to 5, and in the winter they work full time and then they head to school right after work. I do agree with Kieran that mental health is a big issue that we should talk about, and I feel as though it would be good to give students more options in terms of taking school in the summer and having more course offerings in the summer. I think that with the expansion of the summer program, it also resolves some financial issues. For example, more students, international perhaps, would be willing to stay on campus, and that would generate more revenue, which may provide a more affordable housing cost for the university. Perhaps housing can be more affordable because of the return, the restore of demand of housing in the summer. So these are the three things that I really want to work on if I become elected as your VP academic.
Great, thanks guys. That was a good intro to, I guess, the issues we have at hand here. So just to start delving into those issues that we have, both of you did talk about the summer semester, and it seems like you both seem to feel like they are underutilized right mm-hmm. now. So in your opinions, what would a trimester or an expanded trimester system need from your position and from our UBC faculties and facilities for increased support? And Carvin, we'll start with you.
Okay. Yes, I absolutely think that the summer semester is something I would love to work on and expanding. It's really important that students get more course offerings so that they can finish either their degrees earlier or that they can have more time in rearranging their times. For example, student parents, student families, it's important that they can, the two guardians can switch between terms they want to take off. Mm-hmm. And also, as I've said earlier, it's important that international students get the option of staying in over the summer. I think that particularly people who want to take the Vancouver rainy weather term off to go to somewhere more tropical, it's important that our university gives them that option of going home to somewhere warmer as opposed to staying here in Vancouver. So those are some options that I think the summer semester will really provide, which would go into big implications on housing, which I would be happy mm-hmm. to talk about later.
Mm-hmm. And Kieran?
Yeah. So the summer semester is something that Matt Parson, the current VP academic, has been working on with a few other students, including some of our Board of Governors representatives, as well as Dr. Paul Harrison, who's the chair of the Academic Policy Committee for the Senate. Thus far, the changes to the summer term have been mainly structural in nature, so they've decided to split the summer term into two terms within one term. Mm-hmm. So they're each around 6 weeks long, rather than going for a full trimester system.
Right.
I think this is a step in the right direction because it results in the elimination of 3 to 4 week courses. Having personally taken a 3 week course in the summer term, I found that it didn't afford for a great learning experience. It wasn't an opportunity to engage well with the material, which is what we should be doing as students at university. We're here to learn. We're here to become academic scholars, and simply pushing through courses and having this mentality among students that the summer term is a chance to get through credits is not the way we want to go. It's not the kind of environment we want to foster educationally or socially. So what I would like to see happen further is I'd like to see this shift take place in the perception of the summer term by both students and professors. So professors shouldn't think that just because I'm teaching this course in the summer, I can take parts of the course out, because we want to ensure that the quality of education stays the same regardless of when you take a course in the year. So that's something I'd really push for, is try to get this shift in attitude of mm-hmm. the way that people perceive the summer term. In addition to that, I would like to see the summer term increase in the breadth of courses offered, so students can actually think of it as a viable option to take courses to complete their degree. So if a student were to not take a course in the winter, they know that it would be offered in the summer, so they can plan their degree accordingly. And it would also put less pressure on students who are in programs such as the one I'm in, biochemistry, where people have this need to take 5 to 6 courses a term, which doesn't do anything for mental health and doesn't do anything for a learning experience. So if we were able to spread that out over the year and offer more courses, we could get students to spread out their degree and be able to plan it better. And also eliminate some of these mental health and wellness problems we have at UBC. In addition to this, a summer term that offers more courses and has more students taking advantage of it will result in a lot of sideline wins for students, in that we will now become residents of campus throughout the year. This will give us so much more bargaining power with land use, with governance, with transit. When we are residents who are here throughout the year, the university and TransLink will start to recognize that and will take our concerns even more seriously. So I think that restructuring of the summer semester is huge, both academically and non-academically, for this portfolio, for the AMS, and for students.
Just a really quick question before I let you guys get into rebuttals. Yeah. In terms of expanding the course breadth that's offered in the summer semester, that then also becomes an issue of asking for engagement from more professors and so on. And I'm just wondering how you plan to go about this, and like in terms of budgeting and so on and salaries, like how we plan to keep the professors engaged that we need to have a bigger course offering.
Definitely. Did you want me to start on?
Yeah.
I think that is definitely an issue that needs to be considered as well. And that's, I think that's been the major issue surrounding this when it's been considered by the academic policy committee in the Senate. And I think that's something that we need to look at a little bit further. Like I mentioned, it's been mostly structural in nature, the changes that have happened thus far. So that would be kind of what I would go into it if I was elected VP academic, is have the discussions in Senate and with professors and different faculties to see what the best mode of doing this is. Again, like Harvin mentioned, it would give professors flexibility as well. So if professors choose to teach in the summer versus choose in the winter, they can have that option and give them more opportunities to do field work or do research at other times during the year, because not all research can be done during the summer or during the winter. And it varies for different programs. So it's definitely not only gives flexibility to students, it would give flexibility to professors and faculty as well.
Right.
I entirely agree that communication is key in terms of getting involved with speaking with the faculty and encouraging them to stay over the summer to teach, and perhaps giving them opportunities in the winter terms to do field studies. I do disagree with Kieran in that I do think that there is room in our academic setting for 3 weeks long intensive courses. Students learn at different rates, and professors can also manage to teach an entire course that's 3 credits in 3 weeks, and I've taken some of them. I think that it is important to give students the options between 4-month-long courses and 3 weeks courses.
Okay, great. Thank you. We can now go into a little bit of rebuttals, if you guys have anything to say to counter each other. Carvin, you did start that off a little bit there, so I think it is your turn actually to start first, so we can just hand the mic back to you for a little bit of rebuttal if you have anything else to address to Kieran, and if not, we can go right to Kieran.
I would say yes, I do acknowledge that mental health is linked to the intensity of course and how quickly students have to learn the material. I do think that with the option of having courses that are longer, that those students will be taking those options as opposed to the 3 week long courses. And so it's important that we don't take away the 3 week intensive courses away from students who do want to learn at a more intensive level. Also, I feel that social justice is a great health determinant. And so what should happen is AMS should provide more courses that will enhance campus culture over the summer. For example, I think that AMS services and resource groups have limited opening hours, and Safe Walk, for example, closes over the summer. So it's really important to bring some of these safe, equitable services back into our academic life.
Karen? I recognize that students learn at different paces, and I recognize that some students may prefer 3 week courses over others. But I think what the issue is, having personally taken a 3 week course and having a negative experience with it, is that there isn't that level of consistency in the way that the courses are taught. And I feel as though when you're in a 3 week course, it becomes rushed. And as much as we might want to try to avoid that, and professors might want to try to avoid that, they hit this sort of roadblock where they have to get through the material, and some of them will either cut it out or make it go faster. I mean, personally for me, I don't think that it's a positive message to have learned the material the night before a final exam and not have time to go to office hours and be expected to learn that on your own. It's not supporting student learning. A lot of students, especially first-year students coming in, will overestimate their ability to handle a course of that sort. So I feel that there are mental health concerns, and whether or not students recognize that right away, that's another systemic issue, is that students have trouble identifying when they're stressed and when they actually have a mental health issue. The other thing is that it results in irregular time frames between courses. So it could you could end up having a time where you overlap with a 3-week course and a 4-week course or a 6-week course, and you end up with exams that are at variable times, and students can't adequately plan out their summer. And I think that's one of the reasons why Academic Policy Committee shifted towards 2 terms, where you know that these courses will end at this time. You'll have your final exam at this time. You'll have a 2-week break, and then you can start again. It's that regularity that we need to ensure that students can create a regular schedule for themselves. And I agree with Carvin. I would love to see more student services open up during the summer term. And if we have students enrolling in summer classes, we can ensure that the AMS can administer their fee for the summer as well, to ensure that we can have money to fund these services. Because just like Carvin, I'm a huge advocate for all of these student services that are offered. And I definitely agree with Carvin that social justice is really important. And the more we can do to foster a great learning environment for students, the better.
Great. Thanks, guys. I think we're actually going to go back into more of a structured format now, just to make sure we don't run out of time. So we'll go back to a minute and a half for response and then 30 seconds for a rebuttal. So I guess going off what you guys have been saying about a lot of the health and wellness issues, to go deeper in depth in that, what do you think are the current strengths and weaknesses of the current student health and wellness initiatives at UBC right now? And then beyond that, what specific changes would you guys like to see? And Kieran, we'll start with you. So.
Yeah, definitely. So thus far, I've been involved with a group called the UBC Mental Health Network for the last year. And they have some really, really great resources they offer. They're made up of different groups that do advocacy support work, representation for students facing mental health issues. I think on the side of offering student services, the university is doing as much as they can. Obviously, there's always room for more growth, but I think services like Speakeasy, the Mental Health Awareness Club, Kaleidoscope, they're doing awesome things for students who are facing issues. What I would like to see is introduction of mental health in academic policy. So ensuring that when you restructure courses or when you restructure programs, you're considering the mental health impact that you have with the kind of the outline you're giving for students for these programs or degrees. So how many courses you're expecting students to take in a year, how much time you're expecting students to put into learning, and what kind of resources are being offered, and what professors are saying in terms of mental health. So things like whether there's anything said about mental health at the beginning of the term when they go through a syllabus. That's something the Mental Health Network tried to push through Senate, is having something put in the syllabus of each course saying that these are the mental health resources you can go to if you are facing trouble at any time during the year. So we're very much lacking on the academic policy front of ensuring that systemically we're handling the issue of mental health due to academics. I think that's the number one thing that's causing student stress is the amount of academic pressure they're being faced with.
Great. Thanks. And Carvin, over to you.
Kieran, I think that's a really, really great idea. I do think that on the academic front, we are lacking in policies that are to do with mental health. I think my vision for improving mental health is to push for a more interactive environment for mental health discussions to happen. I have, as wellness coordinator of AUS, actually invited somebody to speak from the network. And we held an interactive talent showcase. And I find that with providing events that are based on entertainment, it really draws in people to not feel like victims, but rather students who want to feel empowered and get to know the services better so they can know more about volunteer opportunities or relay information to friends. So I feel on the AMS cultural level, it's really important that we work with existing services that are provided by not just the AMS, but also UBC. For example, the Equity Office, Access and Diversity. It's really important that we connect all these links together in the form of entertainment and empowerment. I feel that in terms of social justice, it's great that we have the AMS resource groups. I am not happy with seeing it being an opt-out fee. However, right now you can opt out from the $1.50 you pay in your student fees. And it's really important that these student groups have the money that they need, because they are throwing events that really critically engage the student body.
And Carvin, I'm going to have to cut you off. Just going over there. But now we've got 30 seconds each for you guys each to counter what you said or to continue talking. So, Kieran, we'll start with you.
I have to agree with everything that Carvin said. Carvin's done some really great work in the area of mental health, and I'm really, really happy to see so many candidates talking about mental health and wellness this time around in these elections. I haven't seen it as an issue in the past, which is unfortunate, but this year we see our presidential candidates, our VP academic candidates, we're all talking about this. So it's obviously something that's important, and I'm really happy to see the university take a stance on this as well with the introduction of a new plan by student health services aimed at combating systemic issues of mental health. And I'd love to see this transferred onto academic policy. And I think both Carvin and I, this is something that would be a huge priority for us if either one of us was elected. So
perfect. Mm-hmm. Thanks. And Carvin, back to you.
Back on the topic of resource groups, I think it's really important that they get the funding. For example, they're working on a proposal right now to introduce queer positive, gender neutral housing. For example, people who are transitioning between genders and also people who don't identify with a gender at that moment, they have to fill out an application that, you know, makes them decide whether they're male or female. So it is important that they do have the money. I'm working with the VP students right now and providing more equitable housing options.
Great. Thank you. Okay. So now both of you had also talked about affordable housing for UBC students, talking about housing during the summer being part of that, but I think you and also some of the candidates that we're missing today, they've all taken very different positions on tackling this, both on campus and off campus. So what are some specific policies that you hope to implement that's going to improve the conditions of housing for all students? And Carvin, it's your turn to start.
So I think it's really important that areas that are central to campus remain academic, and it's important that we, by academic, I mean that they are designated for student residence or for academic purposes. I think we must set ratios for our international students. They have less of a network than those who live perhaps in a further away municipality in the Lower Mainland. So it's important that we do host our international students so that they don't need to go through the stress and, you know, affect their mental health in terms of trying to find housing in a city that they are not familiar with. I think that it's also important that we acknowledge the makeup of our Board of Governors, and so staff housing and faculty housing is important, so there must be a balance. We need to really engage in discussion as AMS.
Great. And Kieran?
Yeah. So affordable housing is a huge issue coming up, mainly because currently the Board of Governors has set out a housing action plan that's currently happening right now, and that's wrapping up in this spring. So what the AMS needs to do is engage students and figure out what students' definition of affordable housing is, because my definition is not necessarily that of most students. So if I was elected VP academic, that would be a huge thing that I would work on, is getting students involved in these consultations and making sure that student voices are heard. And our definition of affordable housing is incorporated into this housing action plan, because this housing action plan is going to dictate what housing looks like on campus for the rest of the development of this campus. So that's a huge thing coming up. And the biggest thing is getting students out to engage with these consultations. Affordable housing is a huge issue for students. And like Carvin, I agree that the heart of campus should remain academic in nature, and that's the place where student housing should be. UBC has set a goal to have, I believe, 53% of students living on campus within the next, I can't remember how many years. But what they have said in consultations with Gage South was that they have designated other areas on campus for student housing. But I think that the issue with that is there's no better place for student housing than the center of campus. And that density should be moved into the Gage South area, so students are having the opportunity to live in a place that is student-centric, where the sub is, where the aquatic center is, where McInnes Field is, where Gage towers currently are. That's where students should be living, and I feel that the university needs to recognize that, yes, students want faculty and staff to have affordable housing options as well, but density for students should be moved to the Gage South area and find other places to put that density for faculty and staff.
Great, thank you. And Carvin, back to you for 30 more seconds. Or?
Okay, yes, I absolutely think that affordability is a huge issue on campus. 2 years in a row, there's been referenda on AMS having a mandate to fight for lowering tuition. I feel that for mandatory fees like the athletics fee, it is important to keep it affordable. I know that there are plans in building a new aquatic center. They had their consultation. It has not gone to the board yet. I know that the external reviewers are coming in to review the departments of athletics at UBC. So it's really important that we take advantage of this review period.
I'm going to have to cut you off again, just over time there.
All right.
And Kieran, 30 more seconds.
I don't have much else to add. I just want to stress that the biggest thing that I would do as VP Academic is ensure that students are involved with consultations. I had an opportunity to go to the consultations for Gage South. There weren't a lot of students there. And I think that students don't understand what's going on. What is Gage South? What are these housing consultations? What does this actually mean for students? And that's the job of the AMS VP Academic, is to translate that to students and make them understand why this is important, why we need their opinion. Because one office making decisions on behalf of all students is not what we need. We need consultation, collaboration, and proper representation for students on these issues.
Definitely, thank you. Yeah, it's definitely an issue that is quite opaque for most students. But yeah, we're just about out of time here, so I think I'm going to give you each, maybe we usually do like a minute, but I'm going to give you 45 seconds each for closing remarks. Just, I guess, a final push for votes, tell us who you are, tell us like bits of your policy that we might have missed, and then that'll be that. So who's it? I think it's your turn to start again,
sure.
Kieran. Yeah, so 45 seconds, it's all yours.
Okay. So again, my name is Kieran Mahal. I'm running for the position of VP Academic and University Affairs, as well as the seat on Senate as a student at large. I'm really running in this election because I care a lot about the AMS. I've worked here for 2 years. I've seen the potential of the AMS, and I really want to ensure that we can go to the best of our potential and make sure that students become more engaged and proud of the work the AMS does, because the AMS really does a lot for students, and we need to make sure that students are engaged in that process. I really want to fight for representation for students and really be a strong voice for students, both to the Board of Governors and to the Senate on academic issues. I've been a student leader on campus for the last 2 years. I know how difficult it can be to engage students. I know how difficult it can be to break barriers to talk to administration. I have that experience, and I'm willing to fight for students, so I really hope you'll give me a chance to work hard for you, because I really am committed to this role. And again, my platform and experience can be found on www.votekieran.com. Thank you so much, and please vote and encourage everyone you know to vote as well.
Great. Thanks, Kieran. And Carvin, over to you.
I'm going to start off with my website, www.carvinlee.com. That's CARVENLI.com. I am involved with the AMS last year and this year also. I have sat on the University and External Relations Committee, and so I've learned a lot about the governing bodies of our university. I am committed and passionate as a student leader to represent students. I've experienced this in my political coordinator role and also my advocacy coordinator role at the AUS. So I feel that with my outgoing personality and my experience, I can really bring on change at the AMS. I definitely feel consultations are very lacking, and it's important that we bring more people to consultations, for example, at Affordability Forum.
Great. Perfect. All right. So once again, those were two of your candidates for the VP Academic position. We had Kieran Mahal and Carvin Lee in studio with us today. So be sure to check out their websites to get their full platforms and more details. Also, make sure that you do vote January 23rd to 27th. So we're going to take a quick break right now just to let our candidates get out of the studio, and then we'll be right back on and sign off, and that'll be that. So stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to CITR News 101. That was our program for today, Monday, January 23rd. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle, and today's show is produced entirely by Martin Lemlin and CJ Mahajan. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned now for Sore Throats, Clapping Hands, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.